AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to another brilliant sport and lifestyle beers here on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio. Well, this week we've got an international sports special and it's the last show in July already. On to August for next week. This week we've got international professional footballer Sam Hyatt, all the way from America, who plays for OL Reign. And we also have Louis Delatra, former F2 driver and F1 test driver, now a dual world champion in FIA endurance. Throw in our SLB sports roundup and we know you're going to love the show. Well, everybody, joining me this week is a superstar lady. She's a professional footballer and she plays for OL Reign in America. It's Sam Hyatt. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good. How are you?
Really well, thank you. Appreciate you giving your time up for us. Early morning for you, just coming to sort of early evening for us. So amazing we can connect. We want to talk, obviously, about your career and what your plans are for the future and how you got into football. But if I could wind it back to start off with, please, just so people get to know you a bit better. You were born in Washington. Who or what were your inspirations initially to get into football?
So I'm actually pretty lucky. Both of my parents played soccer in college. So especially for me, my mom was definitely a role model and an inspiration, someone who I looked up to. I was actually able to watch some of her games when she was older, playing in an adult league here in Washington. And so I think because of that, that got me into soccer at an early age. And also as a result of my parents playing soccer, you know, I was learning about the 99 U.S. Women's National Team. My mom played with Brandi Chastain. So some of those players' names, you know, Mia Hamm, Christine Lilly, Julie Foudy were names in our household. So I think I just grew up around the game and it was definitely something that I was introduced to at a young age and just completely fell in love with it. So here I am, you know, 20 something years later, still playing and still enjoying it.
That's amazing. That's absolutely fabulous. You know, great that you were into it straight away. Great you had a pathway shown by your parents, which is fabulous. What were the opportunities like for girls where you were at that time?
Yeah, so I think I probably did the typical route for a young girl soccer player here in Washington. I played club soccer up until I was 11 or 12, and then the ECNL League started up here in the U.S., and I think that was a great opportunity because through the ECNL, we traveled a lot. We were able to be seen by a lot of different college coaches across the country, and so I think that played an important part of my recruiting process and ultimately helped me get into college and be seen by the colleges that I wanted to play at. And I think I was lucky again in that there was a pretty good structure here in Washington where I grew up, where there was a pathway or a track where I could follow and kind of, you know, check all the right boxes that I needed to get to playing in college, which ultimately, you know, is a big goal for a lot of young girls in the country, but also an important stepping stone, especially at least for me, in order to play professionally.
Yeah, college is huge. And we will come on to college, actually, because you've done fantastically well. But moving through your prep school years, you played for Seattle Preparatory School for 4 years. You were captain. How important and sort of memorable was that experience for you at that time in preparation for the career you had ahead?
Yeah, my high school soccer experience was great. I can't speak for all high school teams because I know the level varies, but mine was actually really good. I was lucky to have a lot of players who actually would go on to play collegiately on my team, so the level was pretty high. I think it was high school soccer really highlighted part of my career that was really just fun playing. I think I really enjoyed playing for my school. It was kind of different, you know, up until that point as a teenager, you've only ever played for your club team, but it was fun to be able to play and represent my school. And at the same time, while I was, you know, like I said, having a lot of fun, we also wanted to be a winning team. We wanted to win state. And I think that's something that has kind of been a goal of mine at every level I've played at. I've always wanted to be part of either establishing or being a part of a winning culture and just having really high standards. So while it was fun playing high school soccer and representing the school, I think at the same time, I still tried to maintain the standards that I would have on, you know, any team I was playing on at the time.
No, I mean, amazing. And yeah, great that you've done so well and you could see sort of how it would prepare you for the future. And towards the end of those school years, you received a couple of awards. In 2015, you were the Washington State Gatorade Player of the Year and in the Best 11 of High School All-American. And then the following year, 2016, you were the Seattle Preparatory Athlete of the Year. A couple of fantastic achievements. What did they mean to you? And did you use that as confidence going forward, or was it just something nice to be honored with?
Well, I think the individual accolades were great, and I'm so grateful for those. But at the same time, I think what was most important to me was I just wanted to help our team do the best that we could. So putting my high school name on those was more important recognition, I would say, than just doing it for myself. And ultimately, my goal during those years was, like I said, we wanted to win state. We wanted to win our league. And so I was playing and working more towards that. So I guess I would say they're nice to have, but I think the things I'm proudest of during that time were the championships and what our team achieved together. And then I think in terms of confidence, I'm not sure how much those awards played into building my confidence. Like I said, I think it was more just something nice to have at the time. I also had just started playing with the U.S. youth national team around that same time. So I think I needed to have confidence for that. And I think I got confidence through those camps as well, maybe more so than from the high school level. But like I said, I think I achieved a lot during that time with my school, and I'm really mostly proud of what I achieved with my teammates there.
Fantastic. Again, just showing your team ethic as well, which is important, isn't it? I mean, football is a team game. Sometimes you have to be, when I say selfish, I don't mean selfish, but you have to focus on your game as well. But it's nice when a whole team comes together.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think I've been fortunate in that the teams that I've been on have all had a similar theme of everyone, you know, again, having a standard of excellence and wanting to be the best. And so surrounding yourself with a culture like that really is the best way to prove going forward.
Absolutely. Perfect way of explaining it. Super. This success achievement was continued throughout your collegiate years, which we touched on before. You attended Stanford, a D1 team, obviously amazing, well-known university, and you played for them. You were 3-time All-Pac 12 winner and a 2-time All-American. I mean, they're just amazing achievements and a way of being recognized. It must have made you extremely proud and really given you that boost.
Yeah, my time at Stanford was so special for a wide variety of reasons. My teammates at that time were absolutely incredible. And today, actually, they're, you know, some of the best in the world. I was lucky enough to be playing with Katarina Macario, Sophia Smith, Naomi Gurma. And so I really was honored to play on that team during that time. And every single year, our goal was to win a national championship. We came into preseason and we would talk about it, and we just knew, every single person in that locker room knew that was our goal. That was what we were striving for. And so everything we did, starting when we all reported on the 1st of August or whenever it was, everything we did was geared towards that. And so to have that mentality and be surrounded by people who had the same goals as you was really an incredible experience. And the fact that we were able to win 2 national championships during that time and go to 3 Final Fours was just amazing, and it's something I'm so grateful for. And honestly, I think as much as I enjoyed my time playing at Stanford with the wins and the teams I was on, I also think it prepared me so well for the NWSL, because again, those things I mentioned, being in a super competitive environment and having to play against some of the best players in the world, that really set me up for success, or set me up the best it could for the jump to the next level. Because obviously here again, you're playing against some of the best players in the world. The training environment is really difficult in the best way. I'm challenged every single day. And so I'm forever grateful that my time at Stanford really prepared me for this next level. And the training environment there was fantastic.
Sam, thank you for that. You said the training at Stanford helped you again leap forward. Was it totally different from what you'd experienced elsewhere in training?
I would say it was definitely different than like the jump from my club team to Stanford. I would just say at Stanford, the standards were just so high. Like, we really did have standards of excellence, and we wanted to try and do our best and be the best every single day. And I would say, yeah, I think it was maybe not new. Like, the idea, the concept of that wasn't new, but I just think the standards were even higher. So everyone really held themselves and the people around them more, or held them accountable to the level that we all wanted to achieve. And I think that was maybe the first time I'd been on a team where it had permeated throughout the entire team that these exceptionally high standards were the ones that we had set for ourselves. And that was what we set out to do. And that's what we were going to do.
Brilliant. And just how it should be. But it's really nice just to hear that. But even though it's college, not professional, it's such a big deal at Stanford that it is like a professional setup. Amazing to hear. Mm-hmm. And then you joined OL Reign in 2019, huge club, and were selected by them in the third round of the draft. Did you again notice the difference between their standard and Stanford? Or was Stanford at such a high level it was just seamless to transfer into OL Reign's way of doing?
Yeah, that's what I think is so wild, I guess, about becoming a professional player, because I absolutely noticed a difference. And at the same time, I think Stanford was the best environment that I could have possibly had in college to try and prepare me. And so I think my time there prepared me the best it could. But at the same time, the jump to the NWSL was definitely a challenge. I think even just for any normal player coming out of college, it can be difficult. And at the same time, I had actually had a major hip surgery right after my last season at Stanford before I started playing professionally. So on top of, you know, coming from the college level, I was also trying to just work my way back into soccer in general. But yeah, I think the biggest difference for me in terms of comparing college and the professional level is just the speed of play. And when I say that, it's the actual speed of, like, the players are moving faster, the balls are moving faster, you have to think faster, your touches have to be cleaner because you have less time, you need to be able to play better with both feet because, again, you have less time.
Yeah.
And all of that is kind of just dealing, again, with the ridiculous speed of play that's so fast, even compared to one of, you know, the best college programs I could have been in. And so I think while it was definitely a challenge in the beginning, I can tell I've grown so much from, like, my first couple games in the league till now. And I think, you know, every preceding game, it gets a little bit easier, or you get a little more used to the speed of play. But it's also like, I think I'm such a better player because of having to be in this environment where I'm forced to think and play quicker and faster. Yes. So I've been learning a lot, but the jump from college to the pro level definitely, I think, helped with that.
Wow. Amazing. Again, that you've talked so highly about Stanford, yet I know OL Reign is the team to look at. It was another massive step up. So great that you took that so easily in your stride. You started with a 2-0 win, which is obviously nice. However, that was during COVID, which I think for everybody was a strange experience. Were you playing behind closed doors? And if you were, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so like I said, my COVID experience even was a little more unique, maybe a little different than even the typical, you know, US pro player experience, because that was during the time that I was still rehabbing from my surgery. So the whole world shut down and I'm in the middle of my rehab post-surgery. I'm flying home. I don't have my tee anymore. I have to find somewhere with, you know, an Ultra G, the special treadmill that you can run on when you're coming back from an injury. So it was all these factors of just trying to figure out how I was going to continue my rehab for those first couple months. And then when we finally did play again in the, for me at least, in the fall of 2020, I think there was decreased amount of fans allowed or something like that. Maybe no fans, people like family only, or people could watch it online. And it definitely was a strange experience playing without fans. It's a lot quieter.
Yeah, I bet it was actually. You can hear everything. I remember watching a few matches of the Premier League on the television, and you can hear everything. It's almost like watching a game on a park, isn't it? You know, because there's no crowd, there's no singing, there's no atmosphere. It's just silence, and you can hear what everybody says. So a real strange experience, and probably something you'll never actually have a true opinion on unless you're actually a part of it. Yeah, thank you for that and giving us that insight. Well, obviously COVID was strange as well because of training. You know, you had bubbles, sometimes you couldn't even go in. How did you keep yourself mentally and physically strong during such a difficult period for everybody?
Yeah, I think everyone will say that, you know, COVID presented some challenges mentally and physically, whether that was, you know, trying to find a training environment when teams weren't going, or just trying to continue and be mentally ready when we weren't really sure when we're going to play or what the training situation going to look like. How are we going to have a season if we can't even travel right now? And I think just for me, the people I surrounded myself with, I think I had a good support system and I was able to, you know, make it through that. I think it also helped having friends and teammates across the country who were kind of going through a similar thing, so we could talk about it together. Yeah. And kind of see what other people were doing to cope or things that were helping. And so I think just continuing to train and do as much as I could and try and retain some sense of normalcy was helpful to me, while also, you know, like I said, talking with other people and knowing that it may have been a difficult time, but, you know, I wasn't the only one going through it. And there were other people I could talk to and count on as well to help get me through that.
No, and that's wonderful. And I presume you've got training plans and Zoom meetings with your team.
Yeah, we kept going with, I think there was like individual trainings for a little bit there. And then, yeah, Zoom meetings and things like that.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, in 2022, you were back playing properly. You started all 19 games for OL Reign, played in a staggering 1,710 minutes in a good season. How good was it to be an ever-present in such a good team?
I mean, it was great. I'm so appreciative that I'm able to play that much on such an amazing team and just contribute what I can to our team's success. We won the Shield last year, but fell short of our ultimate goal of winning a championship. So while I look back on the season overall, there were some good moments and there are things that I'm proud of. At the same time, it was a disappointing end. So still a little bit of a bitter taste, I would say, thinking back on how it ended. But I just know that all those minutes have helped me grow. And even from the beginning of that season to the end of that season until now, I know I'm a better player and I've learned so much. And so every time I play, like I said, I'm just trying to do the best I can for my team and continue to keep learning and growing as well.
Brilliant. Thank you. Fabulous to hear. So we'll just move on quickly before we wrap up today and we'll talk about internationals. On the international scene, you've represented your country under 18, under 20 level. What was it like when you first received that call up and then your first cap and pulling that kit on?
I mean, as someone who grew up, you know, hearing about the national team, watching the national team and just looking up to those amazing women, it was incredible. I still remember getting told I was going to my first national team. I still remember putting the jersey on for the first time. And, you know, it was amazing. It was such an incredible feeling to be able to try and represent my country and just, again, follow in the footsteps of the amazing and, you know, role models and powerful women who had come through the team before me. So to even just be a part of the youth national team level for the U.S. was such an honor, and it's always an honor every single time.
Just what I expect to hear, you know, for someone like you can read your resume, or as I'm doing, I'm talking to you, can just feel your passion, your commitment to the game. And it's just nice that everything that you've achieved, the next thing is still special, if that makes sense. You seem like you take nothing for granted at all.
For sure. I mean, like I said, I've been fortunate to be a part of some amazing teams, and I definitely take what I've learned from each one of them with me, but I'm always continuing to try and do my best and win with whatever team I'm on at the time.
Yeah, no, perfect. And if I could just throw a quick question in there about your playing position. I often ask the younger girls this because it's more to help with development, but what is your best position and what is your favorite position? Growing up, it's surprising how often they're different, if that makes sense.
For sure. I think my best position right now is center back, and I think that's also my favorite position right now, probably partially because it's my best position, I think, right now for me. Yeah. because this is the position where I think I'm best suited to contribute and help the team. And so I think that plays a role in how much I enjoy it. But I definitely think growing up that it's not always the same. It's not always the position that you like the most is not always where you end up as a young soccer player. But I think for me, I have really spent most of my career in this position. I played a little bit of center mid as well, which it honestly contributed to my growth overall, and it helped me become a better center back the time I spent in the midfield. But for right now, yeah, center back is where I think I'm best and also the one I enjoy the most. So.
Brilliant. It's interesting to hear that as well from your side, you know, as you are a professional and as you've already found your best position and your favourite one, as we said. So yeah, just a couple of more things then, Sam, if that's okay. What's your plans and dreams for the future?
Yeah, so for as of right now, my plan is to keep playing here in the NWSL and, you know, hopefully keep playing here with the Reign. I want to keep getting better on an individual level, just keep improving and growing and learning here. But also, as I mentioned, we fell short of our ultimate goal last year of winning a championship. And so my goal is to do whatever I can and whatever I need to do to contribute to this team, you know, winning a championship. So that's definitely a goal of mine and a goal of ours here at the Reign.
Perfect. And then finally, please can you offer some advice and tips for any young players, especially girls, who are looking to have a career in football, whether it's things you need to sacrifice or even if you get a knockback, how you get back on the horse, as it were?
I would say, I guess, two things come to mind if I would say to young girls. I would say, first and foremost, I would make sure that you're, you know, having fun playing. And that sounds so basic, but at the same time, looking back on where I started and where I am now, it is a lot of hard work to play soccer or play football and reach the professional level. And I think that if you are truly enjoying yourself, I think that helps and that goes hand in hand with achieving success, because I think if you're enjoying it and if you're having fun and it's worth it to you deep down, then I think that will help get you through the moments where, you know, maybe it's not so fun. Maybe you don't want to get up out of bed to go do some fitness, or maybe, you know, if you have an injury and you're struggling to make it back on the field, I think remembering why you're doing it all and thinking big picture, like, I love to play this sport and I have fun doing it, I think that will help in the long run. And then I would say one thing, maybe just technically or tactically, to think about is to try and put yourself in the best training environment that you can. I definitely learned that lesson growing up, trying to find, you know, the best training environment for myself, you know, whatever that may look like, whether it's playing up or playing with boys or just playing on a certain team that is going to help you grow. I think that the training environment you surround yourself in or surround yourself with ultimately is what really helps you become the player and grow and learn. And so I think just being thoughtful about the training environment you're creating for yourself is important. And again, that's something I kind of learned but can look back and say I would love to be able to tell any young girl that who's starting out and wants to become a pro.
Well, Sam, what a lovely way to finish it. Perfect advice, good positive advice, and I just want to say thank you for today. I'd love to catch up with you again in a few weeks. For today, I just want to say Sam Hyatt, all the way from OL Reign, thank you very much.
Sounds good to me, and again, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Have a good one.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Well, everybody, joining me today is an absolute superstar in the motorsport world. It's Louis Delatrasse, Switzerland racing driver. Hi, Louis, how are you?
Hello. I'm really good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely brilliant. Thank you for giving your time up. I really, really appreciate that. I just really want to get the listeners to know about you, what you do. We know currently you're competing in three different championships, which means you must be so busy. But obviously a good thing. We'll come on to the championships in a while. So if everyone could get to know you a little bit better, I wonder if you could tell us what it was like growing up, how you got into motorsport, and what really got you hooked into it.
Yeah, it's actually a family story for me. Basically, my dad was racing. He went to Formula One for a few races, but he did mostly sports cars racing with Le Mans 24 Hours. And his F1 stuff was before I was born. Probably I visited my first race in the belly of my mother when I was still not born. And then I was on track, like following some of my dad's races, and I have memories from childhood there. So I guess that's what got me into motorsport. And then, yeah, we had a lot of fun with my dad when he put me in karting and we started together. So that's a really, I guess he never forced me, but I always wanted to do it and always had passion for this sport.
Fabulous. So obviously you had the bug, really. As you said, you went there while you were still inside your mum's tummy, which is fabulous. How did you start out? What was your first in-race action in motorsport?
So now motorsport has evolved so much. You see those 3-4 years old kids, like actually Max Verstappen started like at 2, I think, karting, and right, much earlier than me. My dad was a bit worried that I was too young. When I was 8 years old, I was like, I want to race. He said, well, it's a bit early for karting. Let's go do soapbox. So soapbox is basically downhill. You create your own car with some wood four wheels and you put some brakes on. You make it in your own garage in the winter and it goes downhill, no engine. So you just race as quick as you can. And we had a lot of fun building one in the garage over winter with my dad and making some races. That's actually how I started. And then we showed up to the first race and we saw all the competitors and tried to copy them, and because they had better cars than us. And obviously this was the start of it. When I was 10 years old, straight away went to karting and moved up from there, then single seater and etc. Obviously result was the objective, and as it went well, I could move up.
Great. So, yeah, so you started early. You said you went on karting. A couple of things that I noticed that you've obviously done well at. You were in the Formula Renault that you went for a few years, the GP2 series, and Formula 2 as well. How did those years help you, and what was your highlight during them?
Yeah, exactly. The first competitive championships I did was Swiss Championships in karting, which I won twice.
Yeah.
And then when I was about 15, there was either going international with karting, doing the world championships, European championships. But money is always a big topic in motorsport. And it was either going international, and the amount of money asked was insane, and we didn't have it. And then I got an offer from BMW to race in their Talent Cup, was called, was a junior, like Formula 4, basically, of before. And that was much cheaper to actually race proper single-seater cars. And that's how I moved in. Did my first year there, it was fantastic. Went to Formula Renault, the European Championship, which I won in the end after the third year, and the second in the World Championship. The Formula Renault 2-liter was like a Formula 3 of right now. And then I moved to GP2, which became Formula 2. It was basically the same category, just different cars. Did a few podiums there, never won, unfortunately. I think I was not always the right place, right moment, but right, no regrets. And always tried to move up into Formula 1. Did my Formula 1 tests, had good results, but I mean, in the end, it's very political. There's only 20 spots at the top level, and I didn't make it, but it was very close and there was no regrets.
No, and it is that sort of key thing, isn't it? It's a bit like Formula One, as you said, there's only 20 seats. To liken that, it's a bit like football, for example, in the Premier League. You could have a brilliant season, but you still may not win it. It doesn't mean you've had a bad season. And just because you don't make one of them 20 seats doesn't mean you're not a good driver. You're still a very good driver. But as you said, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's right place, right time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's 20 drivers in Formula 1, 20 in Formula 2, and about 30 in Formula 3. I think the years I was in Formula 2, you know, I was with Lando Norris, Charles Leclerc, Albon, Russell. We were all good. And I think the top 15 of Formula 2, put in the Mercedes those years, which was dominating, or the Red Bull right now, would have done well, very well, because the level is incredible. And I have so much respect for all my competitors, because I think we all fought at so high level, which actually taught me a lot for where I am right now. And I think definitely shaped me up for competitive and trying to always do my best, because you fight against the best constantly, and not everyone makes it to F1. And there's no problem in this, because then obviously the second best route is endurance racing, which I'm in now, and the sports cars, where with other manufacturers, and the level is also incredibly high, and obviously we make a living out of it. So that's always the objective.
Absolutely. And one thing I was going to say was, you mentioned that you were very, very close. And just how close you were, I can say two things. Was that you were put on the F1 Young Driver Program, which obviously is a massive compliment to you. But then you were also named as a test driver for Haas, which, again, is the next step down from having a seat, isn't it?
It is the next step down. I mean, I got reserve driver 2 years. I was doing all the sim development for Ferrari and Haas and F1 for 2 years too. So I was very close, attending a lot of GPs. And I drove the car in Abu Dhabi, I think it was 2019, which was already like putting like one foot in the dream, being very close to it. And yeah, then obviously things didn't turn out this way. Obviously it was very close, I think, for me to be in Formula 1 when Grosjean had his crash in Bahrain with the fire, which I think most of people saw now. He was very lucky to be still alive. It's incredible. Obviously, I'm super happy for him that it all went well. And I was very close to replace him at those last two races in Bahrain and Abu Dhabi. It didn't work out. That's like it is. But I think I have no regrets. I had a super license. And yeah, I think I can be proud of being in that situation of maybe having been in Formula 1.
Absolutely. I mean, how amazing is that? Like, it's every boy's dream, pretty much, you know. And you were, like, within touching distance. And sounds like you were pretty unlucky not to get a drive, which is amazing credit to you again. What was it like to be part of the experience of Roman Grosjean's crash in Bahrain? I mean, it must have been an absolute miracle. Well, it is a miracle, surely, that he escaped pretty much unhurt, wasn't it, as well, really?
Yeah, the crash of Roman, to be honest, was horrible. Roman is a very close friend of mine. I remember watching the race because I was on site. And when I saw this, I think everyone thought he was dead.
Yeah, I agree.
There was no outcome of this. Racing is dangerous, we all know it. I mean, we accept the risk. The safety has improved a lot, but this crash was just insane. And I really thought that day I lost a very good friend. Yeah. And seeing him climbing out of the fire was obviously crazy. A lot of joy to see him walk out. And then I visited him next day in the hospital, and seeing him, he was fine and just slightly burned in the hands. It's incredible. So it was a really bad moment for all of us to watch. Yeah. But the outcome of it is obviously great because Roman's alive and with us and still racing.
Of course, yeah. And it must have been when you saw him, it must have been like a rub your eyes moment.
It was really long, 1 minute and a half when he was on the fire. I don't obviously remember everything because it was, I think everyone was a bit in the shock, but it was very, very long. This 1 minute 30 felt like forever. And I cannot even imagine for his wife, kids, who I know very well, who was home in Switzerland, watching this on TV. I think it's horrible.
Absolutely. Yeah, thankfully, I suppose in a way they weren't there, but I suppose at that time, perhaps they wanted to be, because, you know, you want the first-hand update, don't you, really? Yeah, absolutely amazing and fabulous that he came out so unscathed, really.
Exactly. The safety improved so much thanks to FIA. Also with the halo on the cars now, yes. I think we're much more protected. Sports cars racing, we have a roof, so we're less exposed to danger. But obviously still, that was high speed when you crash, the body never likes it.
No, absolutely. So that's all brilliant. Obviously, after that, you went to the endurance. What was the reason for a switch? Was it because it was the best drive offer you had, or was it something you'd been interested in looking at doing anyway?
Basically, in Formula 2, you don't really get paid. Okay. You have to find sponsors, you have to make it work, because it's a way to try to go to Formula 1, but you cannot make a living out of Formula 2. So it's either you move to Formula 1, or at some point you have to commit to something else. I got an offer over winter from WRT, one of probably the best endurance team in the world right now, and with teaming up with Robert Kubica in the European Championships. And I mean, when I got the offer, it was great. I didn't even hesitate. I took it. And I mean, we went on to win the endurance championship as first timers. And I think this was the start of my endurance career. And I mean, I had no doubts of going. I always wanted to do this and Le Mans because I saw my dad doing it. And it's not like a plan B. It's something I always wanted to do. And that's how it went. Yeah, the offer was great. And I loved endurance racing. I'm so happy right now and enjoying it. So plus the opportunities and yeah, as I said again, in Formula 2, you cannot make a living of it. In endurance racing, that's where you can make a career of 15 or 20 years.
Wow. And that's amazing. Obviously, the long endurance, how do you find that as a driver? Is it something that you had to get used to, or is it something you adapted to quite quickly?
The first thing is ego, because in single-seater, you don't share your car. You're alone.
Right.
You have a team behind you, but you're alone in the car. Endurance racing, race. Obviously, every 2.5 hours, 3 hours, you switch driver and try to bring the car to the end of the race, obviously in a good position. And you need to work together. You need to support each other. There should not be ego. And I always get along well with my teammates, so I think that's worked and suits me well. And obviously, physically, it's tough because you don't sleep. 24-hour race, you sleep maybe 1-2 hours, and you're driving at those very high speeds. It's tiring. You lose 3-4 kilos while you drive at the end of the race. It's insane. So yeah, the physical challenge is very big.
Yeah, I imagine it is. And as you said, ego, I didn't even actually think of that possibility, you know, because I presume cars slightly different, I think, obviously the endurance cars, but like Formula 1 cars and Formula 2 cars, they're actually set up specifically for you, aren't they?
Exactly. You need to make compromises in endurance because it needs to fit everyone's the best, because that's the quickest way to the end.
Yeah,
the races are much longer. In Formula 1, you really have to kind of kill your teammate, because that's the reference. He has the same car as you and you want to be better to keep your job. And for us, it's a bit different. We have to work together to win.
And it's amazing. Fabulous. So you've won a couple of titles, the European Le Mans Series. Tell us about how that was, you know, not only the feeling of winning it, but obviously through the series, you obviously were right up there all the way.
So far, I have to say I've been lucky. I guess I did the right work and right choices, but we won the European Championship in 21 and 22, so the last 2 years.
Yep.
And we're currently leading again in 23, so I hope I can make it 3 years in a row, because it would be pretty fantastic. So we won a lot of races, a lot of nice races. We've been competitive everywhere. We also won the American Championship last year and finished second in Le Mans, so obviously we missed the top step in Le Mans. But the last few years have been great to me, and can only say thank you to all the people who helped me there.
So currently, as we said earlier, you drive in three series. Before we move on to your big race coming up, can you quickly tell us the three series and a little bit about them?
So the first one is the FIA World Endurance Championship, which is including the 24s of Le Mans, which we're racing in next week. This has seven rounds all across the world, so Europe, US and Asia. So this is one of the championship. Also still race full-time in America. Which is an amazing championship, because the people are very different, the culture is very different in America, and they have much more freedom, I think, in the racing and in all how they see things, which is nice, I have to say. And as well, the European Championship, which only takes place in Europe with shorter races. The races are like 4 hours long, so less long, still long, but not as long as the 24-hour one. And this makes around 20 races a year, which is, yeah, a great calendar.
Brilliant. As you said, you won the European Le Mans Series the last 2 years. You're going for three in a row. The big race next weekend is the Le Mans 24-hour, which you've currently just got to. You've got testing this weekend, as you said. Tell us a little bit about Le Mans, what it means, the whole thing attached to it, and your experiences so far in the race.
Le Mans is impossible to explain without attending, I think. It's a fantastic race. First of all, I think this year they are expecting 350,000 spectators for the race, which is, I think, one of the biggest sporting events probably in the world. And on-site, just on-site, 350,000 spectators. So the atmosphere, the ambience is just amazing. Then the track itself is 13 kilometers long. Half of it is on a city, on streets. You have very long straight line, very high speed. We can reach up to, in the past years, 350. This year, the cars are a bit slower, 330 kph. So it's fast. There's traffic. You drive at night. There's very mixed conditions. It can be raining at night. I mean, this race has history, it's special. And I think if you ask any drivers, you'd want more to win Le Mans than winning the championship. So we have a big task this weekend.
Wow. So it's that big that for some, it's rather win the race than the actual championship. So tell us the car you're driving and your race number.
So we'll be racing in LMP2, which is the name for Le Mans Prototypes 2. It's a spec car, so there's 24 very similar cars. Basically, yeah. They're the same, just setup is different. There's three drivers on it. We have number 41, and we're definitely going to push hard to win it.
And you've got a very real chance?
Well, I think so. Actually, in 2021, same lineup, same car number. We were leading after 23 hours and 58 minutes. Oh. And unfortunately, the car stopped in the last lap, so it was really terrible for us because we lost Le Mans. We have revenge to take on this. Last year we finished second, so last 2 years we were either first or second the whole time in the race. So yeah. Hopefully in 23 fourth.
And did you finish second because you'd lapped everyone else apart from the car that passed you?
No, so in 21 we finished far off because we didn't cross the finish line, so
okay.
We didn't get classified.
Oh, okay.
We were leading with 40-second gap, but we didn't classify. Last year in 2022,
yeah,
we finished second in the race, so actually I think we can be quite proud of this, because being 2 years in a row fighting for the victory in a race like this is good. So again, the goal this year is to finish the job and get the win.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to Louis. Thank you for giving us your time today. Is it okay to perhaps speak to you after Le Mans and you can tell us about the experience and how you went?
Yeah, of course. Let's do that. No problem. Hopefully with good news.
Brilliant. Well, for today, Louis Delatraz, Switzerland racing driver. Good luck next Sunday. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We finish off this week's show with our SLB Sports Roundup featuring golf, horse racing, cricket, darts, motorsport and football. We start with golf, and the PGA and DP World Tours hosted the Open. From Britain, the biggest tournament in golf, from Hoylake up in the northwest. It was won brilliantly by Brian Harman from America on -13 with a four-way tie for second, 6 shots back John Rahm, Sepp Straka, Jason Day and the up-and-coming Tom Kim. Well, Brian Harman took control of the tournament on Friday, day two, was six shots clear and ended up six shots clear and never really looked in danger despite torrential weather and a really tough course. It was a great performance. This week, the PGA Tour goes back to America with the 3M Open from the TPC Twin Cities in Minnesota. And the DP World Tour has a break. They're back on the 17th of August with the ISPS Handa World Invitational. The LPGA hosts the Dow Great Lakes Bay Invitational from the Midland Country Club in Texas. This is a pending result, which we'll bring you. This weekend, though, they have the Amundi Evian Championship, which is another major on the women's tour from the Evian Golf Resort in France. Horse racing. The big race of the weekend was the Irish Oaks from Leopardstown from the Curragh, and it was won by English Oaks runner-up Save the Last Dance for that fabulous duo, Ryan Moore and Aidan O'Brien. She now looks a likely candidate for the St. Ledger at Doncaster later in the year. At Newbury, they had a big meeting with a two-year-old trophy of the big sprint race for cheaper yearlings, and it was won by Relief Rally for William Haggis and the brilliant Tom Marcond. She now looks like she could go forward for the Prix Labbé in October in France. The Hackwood Stakes was won by the reliable and super Comanche Falls, who provided yet another last-gasp win running through beaten horses. And the Metal UK Handicap could throw up a superstar with Sweet William for John and Dady Goslin and Robert Habling, easily winning that race, which has always been used for an Ebor trial. This weekend, it's the big meeting at Ascot with the King George and Queen Elizabeth Diamond Stakes. It's a three-year-old and older horse championship over the 1 mile four trip. The three-year-olds, we said we like August Rodin and King of Steel. Older horses, Emily Upjohn, Pile Driver and Hook'em. If the ground is soft, we like Emily Upjohn, who ran close to best three-year-old around in Paddington in the Coral Eclipse, and she has great form. The international handicap, we like Biggles, who gave us a big winner last week, and also look out for Perotto and Croupier. Glorious Goodwood next week, and three to look out for. In the Goodwood Cup, the up-and-coming star Gregory, in the Sussex Stakes Paddington, and Each Way and Nostrum, and the Nassau, a shootout between the three-year-old French champion Blue Rose Cien and Holly Doyle on Nashua, our good friend and a great horse. The Galway Plate over the jumps takes place in Ireland with Kilcroot and Fury Road, the two main protagonists. If Kilcroot gets his jumping correct for a young horse, he should be very difficult to beat. A sad note in the cricket. The Ashes have been finalised with Australia retaining them due to rain. England put themselves into a brilliant position in the fourth test, putting Australia into bat. They got them out for 317 with Chris Wokes getting 5 for 62. England replied with 592 with some amazing scores. Zach Crawley, 189. Johnny Bairstow, 99. Joe Root, 84. Harry Brooks, 61. Moeen Ali, 54. And Ben Stokes, 51. In a brilliant display. And by the end of day three, they had Australia 4 down, needing still over 160 to make England bad again. But the rains come in. They got 2 hours play on Saturday where England got another wicket. Australia finished on 217 for five. And sadly, day five was washed out, which means Australia are 2-1 up with one to play. And they retain the Ashes. The final test starts this week at the Oval. And England will be going all out to make it 2-2. The Darts World Match Play final was a one-sided affair, despite it being a great final. Nathan Aspinall beating Johnny Clayton 18-6. Michael van Gerwen got knocked out in round one, and Gerwen Price and Michael Smith both got knocked out in round two. Bo Greaves defeated Mikura Suzuki in the first ever Women's World Match Play final, and they were both fantastic tournaments. On to motorsport and two wheels. MotoGP are back next weekend, August the 6th, with the British Grand Prix from Silverstone. Well, Superbikes are back this weekend with round 8 with the service check round from Most in Czechoslovakia. British Superbikes held round 6 with races 16, 17 and 18 from Brands Hatch using the Grand Prix circuit. And the sprint race was won by Ryan Vickers on the OMG Racing Yamaha. A brilliant ride. He beat Danny Kent on the Lovell Kent Racing Honda with Christian Idem back in third on the Oxford Products Racing Ducati. Normal order was restored in race 2 with Tommy Bridewell winning on the Beer Monster Ducati from Christian Idden, who had put in another great performance, and Danny Kent as well finishing third. And in race 3, Tommy Bridewell won again in a fantastic race, a three-way battle all the way to the line. He beat his teammate Glenn Irwin on the Beer Monster Ducati as well, with Ryan Vickers, the sprint race winner on the OMG Racing Yamaha, taking third. Tommy Brywell leads the standings on 258 points. He is 24.5 points in front of his teammate Glenn Irwin, who's on 223.5, with Kyle Ride, the other OMG Racing Yamaha rider, back in third on 181. They're back with round 7 on August 11th to 13th, with races 19, 20 and 21 from Thruxton using the full circuit. Speedway World Cup started this week with two semi-finals, semi-final 1 and semi-final 2, where the winner of each one joins the seeded Poland through to this weekend's final. And then there's a runoff meeting between the second and third from semi-final 1 and 2 to get the fourth team in that final this weekend, and that will be the winner of the race-off. NASCAR and the Pocono 400 was ran at Pocono Raceway. It was won by Denny Hamlin, driving the Toyota Camry for Joe Gibbs Racing. Second place was Tyler Reddick, also Toyota Camry for 23XI Racing. And third place, well, it was a Toyota 123 for Joe Gibbs Racing, Martin Truex Jr. Martin Truex Jr. also leads the total standings, driving his Toyota Camry on 711 points. William Byron is now second, driving the Chevy Camaro for Hendrix Motorsport on 681. And Denny Hamlin is in third, also Toyota Camry for Joe Gibbs Racing on 656. IndyCar, and it was a two-race weekend at Iowa Speedway, and it was won by Mr. Iowa, Joseph Newgarden, who won Saturday's race, the Hy-Vee Homefront 200 for Team Penske, where he beat his Penske teammate Scott McLaughlin with Pato O'Ward for Arrows McLaren coming through the field with third. And he also won on Sunday the Hy-Vee One Step 250, this time beating another Penske teammate Will Power with Chip Ganassi Racing's Alex Palou coming through the field for third. Alex Palou leads the standings for Chip Ganassi on 477. Being closed down a little by Joseph Newgarden for Team Penske, he's now 80 behind on 397, with 40 further back to Scott Dixon for Chip Ganassi, who's in third. They're back on August the 6th with the Big Machine Music City GP from Nashville, Tennessee. Formula E, and this weekend is a two-race weekend from London with the British EP around the famous streets. They are rounds 15 and 16. And in Hungary, we have the Hungarian Grand Prix around the famous Hungaroring. Well, there was a difference on pole position. It was Lewis Hamilton for the Mercedes. He pulled out a Lewis lap, and it showed in the race where he went back to fourth, but still drove pretty well. Max Verstappen unsurprisingly won, this time by half a minute in his Red Bull, beating the brilliant young flyer Lando Norris, who's claimed his third rostrum in a row for McLaren, and third place Sergio Perez coming from ninth in his Red Bull. Max Verstappen leads the standings on 281 points, fully 110 points clear of his teammate Sergio Perez, with third place Fernando Alonso in the Aston Martin on 139. Red Bull again are dominating the constructor standings on 452. They are 229 points clear of Mercedes on 223, who are now 39 in front of Aston Martin on 184. A few things to tell you in football. Manchester United have made another big signing with Andre Onana, the goalkeeper, coming from Inter Milan to Manchester. And they also had their first big friendly of the season, where they took on Arsenal, last year's second place in the Premier League, and Manchester United beat them comfortably 2-0. The Women's World Cup is in force with all the big teams having their first match. England beating Haiti 1-0. Australia winning, Switzerland winning, Spain winning, Holland winning, Germany are yet to play. However, France could only manage a 0-0 draw against Jamaica, and that was a bit of a shock, but I still back them to go through. We'll bring you further updates with the Women's World Cup as it progresses through the tournament. And that's our SLB Sports Roundup. Well, everybody, that is the end of another brilliant show. I want to say thank you to our two international guests. Sam Hyatt, all the way from America, plays for OL Reign in the top league. She is a fantastic guest and a brilliant footballer. And Louis Delatras, who started off in karting, followed his dad's footsteps into F1 as a test driver after a brilliant F2 career. Now he's joined the ranks of the FIA Endurance, where he is a dual world champion. Thank you to you, the listeners, as always. We hope you are happy and satisfied with the content that we bring you. We always strive to make it the best we can. And to Johan, Rafaela and the whole team from UK Health Radio for giving us this amazing platform. We will see you all next week.